Hello, welcome along. It's another episode of the famous Fun Kids Science Weekly podcast. My name's Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a listen, a stream, a download, and a play. We've got sort of a spacey theme going on today. Not officially spacey, but there's a lot of spacey stuff that's happening. We will be chatting to someone from one of the most famous science families ever. Her name is Lucy Hawking. Have you done the maths inside your head? She's Stephen Hawking's daughter. Stephen Hawking, one of the most famous scientists ever of history, at least of the 20th and 21st century. Anyway, she's written a brand new book with the help of her dad and a ton of other scientists as well. And it tries to answer all of your questions about space and the universe and everything. And she will be on this show in a little bit to tell us more about it. I'm also going to get her to answer one of your questions as well. So if you've been onto the Apple Podcast Store and sent us something spacey, she might be answering it for you. We're not just looking up from the Earth either. We're also going to drop down into it. We're looking at the deepest hole that we have ever made on this planet. And I will also answer some of your questions. Today, they're all about bees and eye colour. First, let's start and get into space, shall we? Let's get an episode from the smartest school outside of the solar system. This is Deep Space High.
Deep Space High, destination Mars.
Jump into your wormhole and travel to Deep Space High. The school is space. But hurry, because lessons are about to begin.
Afternoon class. Okay, settle down. Now, the scientists on Earth are getting very excited about a certain planet in their solar system. Anyone know which one?
Is it, Earth? After all, that is where they all live.
Well, of course they're interested in Earth, Quark. But that's not the one I'm talking about. Although, the one I'm thinking about has got a lot in common with Earth, if that helps.
Well, a lot of people on Earth are very interested in Mars. Is it Mars?
That's right. So what do we know about Mars? Let's take a look. All right, what have you got? Stats. You've got your hand up first, as usual.
Mars is the fourth planet from its sun and is the second smallest planet in the solar system. It's named after the Roman god of war, although I really don't know why. He wasn't planet-shaped.
It's because of the planet's red glow, like the blood of war. Ew! Is the surface covered in blood?
Of course not. Mars is red not because of any horrible blood disaster, but because of a mineral called iron oxide that's very common on the planet's surface. Let's zoom in and check out the terrain. Mars is a terrestrial planet. It's rocky with craters and mountains, not a gas giant like Jupiter, Saturn and...
Sorry, sir.
Thank you, Quark. Mars has a thin atmosphere, composed primarily of carbon dioxide. An interesting fact is that even though Earth is much bigger than Mars, they both have approximately the same amount of land mass. That's because most of Earth is covered in water. There's therefore plenty of land to explore on Mars.
Not much good if you want to take a boat, though.
Another interesting fact about Mars is that Martian gravity is only a third that of the Earth's. This means you could leap nearly three times higher on Mars. Quark, that isn't an excuse to start jumping around.
Sorry, sir. I need the bathroom.
All right, you're excused. Let's zoom in on some of the sights on Mars.
That is the biggest mountain I've ever seen.
It's not a mountain. It's a volcano and the tallest one we know of in the solar system. It's 21 kilometres high and 600 kilometres in diameter. Even though it's billions of years old, scientists think it could still be active. What next?
What a horrible storm. Is it made of dust or sand?
Both. Mars has the largest dust storms in the solar system. They can last for months and cover the entire planet.
I don't think I'd fancy a summer holiday there.
Or a winter one. Mars has seasons just like on Earth, but they're much longer because Mars is further away from the sun.
How long is a year then?
687 days, getting on for double that on Earth. Each day themselves are about the same as on Earth. 24 hours and then an extra 9 minutes.
So why does it get so cold? Is it because it's so far away? I mean, I can see the sun there, but it looks much smaller than it does on Earth.
That's right, the seasons are more extreme too, because Mars's orbit is in an elliptical shape. That means when it gets cold, it gets really cold. Even the hottest summer's day would not be much above freezing. Not exactly beach weather. Let's zoom out and see the whole planet. There's a couple of other important things to see.
Mars has moons. Who knew?
Yep, two moons called Phobos and Deimos. Although sometime in the next 2 to 4 million years, Phobos is expected to be torn apart by gravity, leaving a ring of dust and debris around the planet.
Like Saturn. Sounds pretty cool. Well, freezing, in fact.
Deep Space High, Destination Mars. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
Right, it's question time. I think this is my favourite part of the show. It's where you send me your questions, something sciencey, wriggling around your brain. You can't quite work out the kinks. Let me do all the legwork for you. You just need to fire it over to the Apple Podcast Store as a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly. You find us on there, leave your name so I know who you are. Drop us 5 stars, that will help me see it. Then there's a little comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. This one is from Max. The title of this, because you get to leave a title, it's headlined on the Apple Podcast Store, is Awesome Podcast, brackets, Max's Beasting Question. I like both of those. Right, Max asked this. His big beasting question is, why do bees die after just one sting? It's a fantastic question. It's one of those things that until recently I thought it was all made up. I thought it was an old wives' tale. Someone said this. I thought, why would they die after just one sting? It makes no evolution sense at all. Evolution is all about staying alive. Why would bees sting if it meant that they died? But it's true. There is a type of bee that stings once and then it dies. Honeybees. And it makes sense because they die saving the hive, making sure no one is around to pinch their honey or to threaten the hive. They sacrifice themselves. And they make sure they cause maximum damage possible. That's why they die. Because they drive their stinger into the prey. They ram it in as deeply as possible. They cram it right in there. But their skin is too weak to keep hold of the stinger. So when they try and pull it back out after they've done the stinging, they rip their abdomen open. And that's what kills them. It's amazing how the world works, that bees have evolved to do that. To save the rest of their kind, one will kill themselves. Such a great question, Max. Nice question, nice title as well. This is from Lily, who's in California. She has one blue eye and one green eye, and she wants to know why. It's called heterochromia, Lily, and you're actually quite rare, you're quite unique. Under 1% of the whole population have it. One eye that's one colour, one eye that's the other. Now, usually it's from your genes, so it's more likely that someone else in your family also has heterochromia with two different eye colours. Sometimes it's caused by injury. Normally, it's through the genes because the colour of your eye is determined by the amount of a pigment in it. The pigment is called melanin. That's what colours it. It also colours your hair as well. Now, the more melanin you have in your eyes, the darker the colour. So if you've got one blue eye and one green eye, it's because one of your eyes, the green one, has got a little bit more melanin, the pigment, than the other one. And that's probably passed down through your genes. Thank you so much for the question, Lily. If you've got one that you want answered on this show, you need to leave it as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, this week, we are talking about a brand new book. It's almost an encyclopedia in the best possible way of the word, really. It's trying to help you answer every single question that you might have about space or the galaxy or just everything. It's called Unlocking the Universe. And check this out for some authors, right? It's written by probably the most famous scientific family in the world, Stephen Hawking and Lucy Hawking, and she is in the studio to tell us loads more about it. Hey, Lucy.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. I've got so many questions about this because you've written a previous series with your dad and with some other scientists. This was the George series. Can you just tell us how this came from those?
So the George series came about because a 9-year-old boy went up to my father and said, "Stephen, what would happen to me if I fell in a black hole?" Now, at the time, my father was probably the most famous scientist in the world. And we all just noticed the confidence and the enthusiasm with which this boy addressed him. He had a question and he realised that my father would be the right person to answer it. So my father, quick as a flash, said, "You would be turned into spaghetti." Meaning you would be shredded by the forces of gravity. But it was really striking that my father used a terminology that we all related to, because we all know what spaghetti is. And black holes, mysterious, distant, abstract and complex, but spaghetti is something we all understand. And so my father gave an explanation that we could kind of all relate to. And so I thought, well, this is brilliant. This is what we need to do. We need to take kids' questions. We need to take this idea of being a space adventurer, of going flying too close to a black hole, and write a story about it. So we wrote George's Secret Key to the Universe, which is the first book in which someone does fall into a black hole. And then we kept going because we realised we had so many other fascinating things to write about. And because we got so many questions for kids, we realised there was so much that kids out there wanted to know. So we kept on going. And what we did is we asked colleagues of my father's, we asked scientists that I met, or if I went to a science lecture and I thought, wow, that's really fascinating. I want that material to be available to young readers. Then I would go up to them afterwards and say, that was super cool, but can you write it all down for kids now? And all the scientists said yes. And so we ended up with this collection of essays, which you find throughout the six book series. I came to the end of the sixth book and my father had sadly passed away. And I knew it was time for the series to finish, but I still felt like there was another book out there. And so we put all the essays together just to see what would it look like if we put all our science content together. And then we were like, wow, there is so much here. We should make a book of this.
But just looking at the contents page, I promise you, listening right now, every question that you have about the universe is answered in some form here. I mean, it's 400 pages long. It takes us through the past to dark matter, life in space, time travel, what's happening in the future. I get asked a lot of questions.
Right. Well, you've got all the answers now. And these are literally world-leading scientists writing for kids. A lot of these scientists had never written for young readers before. And they all wanted to. That was really, really noted. When I went to them and I'd go to like these super distinguished, kind of slightly scary scientists and say something like, would you like to write about aliens for kids? And they'd go, oh, I'd love to. That sounds great. Which was really, really nice. I really appreciated how much they wanted to share what they found fascinating and cool about their research with a young audience. So that was amazing. And then all the essays are kind of written like a story. So they're all a story for a young reader. They're not academic. They're not dry. They put these topics into a context which we can all understand. And so they kind of take us out on these amazing journeys. But they start with a point of relevance and then they take us out there to the universe or back in time or into artificial intelligence or wherever it is we're going.
But there's so much to cover. This is what I mean, because I get asked a lot of science questions. You're from the most famous scientific family in history, give or take.
Give or take. I think a few people might dispute that.
Newton might be.
I feel like we're going to get a call from the Einsteins now going, I'm sorry, that's just not the case.
So what I mean is that you must get asked so many questions. How did you figure out what is going in this book?
Well, so as I said, because we drew the content from the six book series, and that was quite specific. So the first book is about how stars form and how they become black holes. The second book is about all the ways human beings have devised to travel across the universe. So it's about optical astronomy, radio astronomy, robotic space travel, human space flight, and ultimately about theoretical physics, about how we travel across the universe using just our minds, which is amazing. The third book is about the Big Bang. The fourth book is about computers and how we've used computer technology and how we've become reliant on it, what it can do and what it can't do. The fifth book is about water and why we search for water in space. What is the relationship between water and life? And then the sixth book is about the future. And it's really about climate change and artificial intelligence. And so that was kind of where we'd drawn all our material. So we have all this material. And then I added some essays. I went out and got some new essays for this book for things that we hadn't really had any opportunity to talk about, but that I thought were really important for young readers to read about. So like there's a brilliant essay which is called Flat Earthers, Moon Hoaxers and Anti-Vaxxers. And it's a scientist and an expert writing about why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Why do people believe things like we never landed on the moon or the earth is flat? And so I think that's a really kind of important. And there's actually something she writes that I'd quite like to read for us. Would that be OK? Because I think this is really important. She's talking about why is it important for scientists to get out there and talk to people? She says, as scientists, we should seek to engage with people who have doubts or are disappointed by and suspicious of science. It's also very important for scientists to communicate their work effectively, by making it clear how what they do is relevant to other people. Finally, and perhaps most difficult of all, scientists should seek to build trust with their audience. This involves actively speaking out about science, but also resisting any urge to ridicule people who do not share our beliefs, as this will not foster trust. Instead, it is important we listen to them to find out where they got their information from and consider why they might believe it. This way, we can start to develop a positive relationships between scientists and the public and prevent the spread of damaging misinformation. Now, I think that's really important. I think that speaks to the heart of what we're trying to achieve here. We're trying to make information and scientific theories and concepts available to readers in an accessible and an engaging way that builds trust and helps people to believe in the work of scientists and hopefully stops them being distracted by strange theories or bogus ideas that could take them off down a route that could ultimately be very damaging.
Because I think there is a similarity between a conspiracy theorist and a scientist. I think at root, you're from the same heart, and that's being cynical, being critical,
absolutely,
wondering why things are the way they are. Is this actually why it is?
That's so true. I mean, Galileo, for example, you know, he looked up at the skies and he thought, well, I don't believe that everything goes around the earth. I don't believe it. And I'm going to go out. I'm going to seek evidence to find that what I've been told is not so. And so he did. He saw the moons going around Jupiter and he realized that not everything goes around the earth. And of course, that is the beginning of our modern understanding of the solar system. So yes, thinking critically is incredibly important. But you're absolutely right about conspiracy theories, kind of thinking like scientists, but somehow diverging into this path of believing in these theories that have a kind of basis in malice or destruction, and kind of refusing to ignore the hard evidence pointing in the other way.
It's using that energy in the right way, isn't it?
That's right.
I think you mentioned what we know about modern science, and it seems that we know quite a lot, but there's still obviously a lot more that we don't know. But we're kind of looking at, it's like a blurry picture, isn't it? We're kind of figuring it out as it all becomes clear. What do you think is left to find out? Is there something that's out there in the universe? Is there something that's the fabric of life that we haven't got yet?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what's really exciting for kids now, is that the big questions are still out there to be answered. How did life begin on Earth? What did happen at the Big Bang? Is there anybody else out there? What is consciousness? Can we create a computer that is as intelligent as a human brain? So these are all huge questions that we're going to need these kids to grow up and become scientists in order to answer. And then if you look at it in a different way, there are the challenges that we need to confront, and the answers to them probably will come from science and technology, climate change, being the big one. But then obviously we have other ones, the spread of pandemic diseases, that's going to need a response based in science and technology. All sorts of, you know, how do we produce enough food to feed the world without damaging the environment? How do we ensure people have access to clean water? And more kind of conceptually, what do we do about growing social inequality? How do we ensure the welfare and the happiness of the population of the world? Do we need to start thinking about founding colonies in space? You know, there's so much to do, and they're really huge and exciting things for kids to work on.
Now, can I ask, what was it like growing up when you've got one of the greatest scientific minds in history is your dad? Very simply, what is that like?
Oh, that's so funny. I get that question all the time.
And I can imagine. I thought I would just cover it at the base.
Yeah,
now.
No, let's get it out the way. So when I was growing up, my dad was my dad, and just like everybody's dad, when you're quite young, you sort of see your family as a template for what families are. And I suppose I didn't realise that there was anything particularly unusual about having a dad who was a scientist, even though I do remember on a form at school, we had to write down what our parents did. And everyone else wrote things like teacher, lawyer, businessman, and I put cosmologist. And the teacher had to ask me what that was. And we had lots of, my dad had, both my parents were very sociable, very dynamic, very friendly people. And they had loads and loads of friends, and the friends were often science-based, and they would come around in the evening and they would have dinner and they would chat and they would talk about all sorts of really exciting, interesting, extraordinary topics. And as kids, you know, we were asked to join in and ask questions. And I suppose I thought that was kind of normal until I grew up and I realised that most kids don't have access don't have the opportunity to meet a scientist and ask them questions and chat to them. And in a way, that's why I've tried to do what I've done with my work, which is to use this incredible privilege to have been able to meet all these people, to be able to talk to them. And I've tried to make that material available to kids who don't have that kind of background so that they too can have their this feeling like, my questions are being answered, I'm chatting with all these scientists, they're telling me what they know.
I'd love to understand what makes, something that really fascinates me, what makes one person better at another thing than another person. Like, we've all got the same brain, like fundamentally, it's something that's in our head. What makes one person so much better at science to be able to understand things that are in the fabric of the universe than someone else that's maybe good at sport?
That's super interesting, isn't it? And although we fundamentally have the same human brain, it's clear that our brains work in different ways. Some people, like my father, for example, Albert Einstein, other great scientists, have this ability to be very comfortable with abstract concepts. Mm-hmm. My father, because he was ill for a very, very long time, so he was a disabled man and he used a wheelchair, he used a computer to speak. It's very important, actually, for kids to remember that we're all very familiar with his computerized voice. And he started using a computer because a long illness took away his ability to have a natural speaking voice. But I just like to remind kids when I'm talking to them that it's a real person talking to them, using technology to give himself a voice. So he also lost the use of his hands, so he wasn't able to write on pen and paper and to type. So he taught himself how to visualize mathematics, and he did it by using kind of 3D shapes in his brain. So it was very kind of visual and colorful and geometric inside his mind. And that, I don't believe that I would just be able to do that.
No.
I don't think I've got that facility. So I think it's very important to stress to kids that we all have different talents, and you need to find, what is your talent? What do you enjoy? What do you feel passionate about? How can you bring your own unique viewpoint to bear on the world? Part of the point of this book is, you don't all have to be a scientist. You don't have to grow up to be a scientist. That's not what we're saying at all. We just want you to have an ability to think critically, to critically consume information and to ask questions and to think about the answers you're given and to be able to frame and counter an argument. That's really what we're going for here.
Speaking of questions,
I
invite questions to the show. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered, you need to leave it as a review for the podcast over on the Apple Podcast Store. Either I will do the legwork or I will get some of the greatest minds in the field to do it for you. And how about this? Lucy Hawking is going to answer the question from Martin Brown. Hello, Martin. Thank you for this. Martin asks, Lucy, I thought you could help us with the book with this one. Why are there black holes?
Okay, I'm going to actually read you something from the book now. So this is Black Holes, and it's by an amazing young scientist called Sasha Hacko. Sasha was one of my father's students, and she worked with him on his last books, his very last theories about black holes. So let's read what Sasha has to say. She says, gravity acts between any two objects, between the ground and your feet, between your body and the book, and even between the pages of this book. The strength of the gravity depends on how massive the objects are. The pages of this book are so light that the gravity between them is unnoticeably tiny. But when there are objects as big as the Earth or the Sun, we start to feel the effects of gravity. The gravity between the Sun and the Earth is what keeps the Earth in its orbit around the Sun. It is the gravitational pull of the Earth that keeps us obediently fixed on its surface. If we jump up in the air, we always come back down again. If we throw a ball up into the air, it also falls back down. But if we throw it hard enough, really, really, really hard, it will travel so fast as to escape from the Earth's gravity and never return. This is how we get rockets to the moon. We have to launch them extremely fast into space. There is a special speed required for an object to leave the Earth's gravity called escape velocity. It's dependent on the mass of the Earth. Objects more massive than the Earth have a higher escape velocity. We'd have to launch the rocket even faster in order to stop it falling back down. When the object is really huge, so that the gravity is extremely strong, the escape velocity can reach the speed of light. Nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. It is our universal speed limit. This means that nothing, not even light, can escape from these enormous objects. They suck in everything around them. These massive objects are called black holes. The distance around the black hole at which light gets too close and gets pulled in is called the event horizon of the black hole. So in a way, the name black hole is a bit strange. It isn't really a hole at all. it's actually full of a huge amount of matter.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because that's a perfect answer and it still raises more questions.
I know, that's the problem. The questions. But you see, my father actually said that this was something about the nature of the universe. And he said it's one of the really exciting things about being a scientist is that when you get an answer, it's not an answer at all. Yeah. It's another question. And actually, he said that's what he really liked about being a scientist is that the work was never ending, like the universe.
Amazing. Well, there's the answers to every, as I say, every science question you've ever wanted to read in the brand new book, Unlocking the Universe. Lucy Hawking, thank you so much for telling us more. For this week's Dangerous Dan, we're headed deep into Russia to go deep into our planet. The Kola Super Deep Borehole. It's the result of a project to drill as deeply as possible into the Earth's surface, into our crust. Now, boreholes are little offshoot holes that branch from a central hole. So you've got one really deep one, and then twigs come off like on a tree, and some go this way, some go this way, and they try and get those as deeply as possible. Now, drilling on this one began on the 24th of May 1970 in the Kola Peninsula, which is pretty much right at the tip of northwest Russia. If you know your geography, when you're looking at a map, it's almost on the border with Finland, right on the northwest. Now, what's interesting is that humans pretty much know no more about what's down deep in Earth as they do what's way up in space. Because it took the Voyager 1 satellite 26 years to leave our solar system, which is 6.5 billion kilometres away. And in that same time, in those same 26 years, we've only dug 12 kilometres below the Earth's surface. We'd gone much further out into space than we had gone underground. Now, the deepest hole in the Kola Super Deep Borehole, it's quite a tongue twister, is called SG3. It's 9 inches wide. It travels 7.5 miles down into the Earth. And at the deepest point of digging, temperatures got to 180 degrees Celsius. The heat was so high that the digging was forced to be stopped. It was for some purpose, though. They weren't just digging for the fun of it. They found activity and fossils in the rocks that were in surprisingly good condition from 2 billion years ago. It helped give them a better understanding of what happened in the past. Now, the digging was stopped in 1995, and the hole, thankfully, has been sealed. Which means, kind of sadly, you can't have a peer into the molten core of our Earth. We've answered all sorts of your questions this week on the show, travelled up into space for some of them. I've answered them on bees and on eyes. It's time to look a little bit closer to home and answer some of your questions with Technomum. She's our gadget genius.
Technomum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology. Welcome back to Tech Trivia, the game show that tests the technical talents of our tremendous contestants. And playing this week, it's Technomum!
It's brilliant to be here.
Well, we're into the final round, so let's have some brilliant answers as we spin the wheel. And today's category is materials. Your time starts now. Your first question, why is the choice of materials important?
That's easy to explain. Engineered products have a job to do. How well they do the job will depend in part on the materials used. You wouldn't want a hammer made out of wool or a cushion out of rocks. Choosing the right material is an important part of the engineering process. But it's not quite as simple as just picking out a material that would do the perfect job. Some materials might take a long time to be made or might be very expensive. Maybe the ideal material is so rare there just isn't enough to make enough of the products you need. But the clever thing about engineering is that it's sometimes possible to design brand new materials or improve on what's out there. Material engineers use chemistry, biology, and other types of science to create lighter, cheaper, and stronger substances than the choices already available.
Great answers. Next question. Name a cool innovation that engineers have made with new materials.
Oh gosh, there's tons. There's graphene. That's a form of carbon that's stronger than steel. And a graphene aerogel that's 7 times lighter than air and can soak up over 900 times its own weight. Now that would be super useful for things like soaking up oil spills. Scientists have also created an artificial silk by finding the gene in spiders' webs and creating it in the laboratory. The silk can be produced much more quickly than the natural type and is much stronger. And another one is a scarily mega strong glue. It doesn't just stick the surfaces of things together, it sticks their molecules together. It's so strong that when it was being tested, the machine broke before the glue gave up.
Great answers. Now stick around for the final question. Name a job where you might need to think about materials.
Why not be a carbon fibre engineer? Vehicles of all kinds, from bikes to cars to planes, can all be made with some form of carbon fibre. That's a light, flexible and tough material. Being light is especially important when you want to go fast, because the heavier something is, the more fuel it will take to move it. And fuel costs money. Carbon fibre fabricators take designs and make them real. It's even being used to create planes to take people into space.
Well, with those answers, you've gone interstellar. What a technological triumph, a sterling science performance. And you're our winner today.
Technomum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology. Find out more at funkidslive.com/tech-trivia.
Right, it's time for this week's Science in the News. The UK is going to lead a space mission to get an absolute measurement of light reflected off the Earth's surface. Now, the information that we get will be used to help reduce uncertainty in the projections of future climate change. So by seeing where the sunlight is reflected, they can figure out if the predicted temperatures for the future are correct. Now, scientists think that they found the world's oldest asteroid crater in Australia. It's about half the age of the Earth. This is going to blow your mind, right? It's 2.2 billion years old. If that's half the age of the Earth, it means the world is more than 4 billion years old, which is just crazy. They think it may explain why the planet recovered from the Ice Age. In the middle of what they found, there are crystal rings. You know when you cut a tree in half and you get the rings in the stump that help show you how old it is? It's a little bit like this. The tiny rings hold bits of uranium, which help scientists figure out how old it is. They think that the asteroid hitting the Earth helped warm the planet up and bring it out of the Ice Age. And finally, this is a good one. A 17-year-old intern at NASA helped find a new planet. Wolf Cookier was helping out at the space agency in America, checking pictures from its super strength satellite, when he noticed something strange. Something too bright to be a star. Turns out it was a new planet. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for having a listen. If you've enjoyed what you heard, please do make sure you review us over on the Apple Podcast Store. By the way, that is the best place for you to leave a question that you want answered. I've got all sorts of brilliant guests lined up to answer some of your questions. I mean, check out the one we had today. Lucy Hawking, from one of the most famous science families ever. She answered one of your questions. I can get genius experts just like her to do the same for yours. But you need to leave it for me as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. You can hear all our fantastic science series on there as well. You've heard some today. We've got loads more. You can get them on Apple, you can get them on Google, Spotify, wherever you get your shows from. And Fun Kids are a children's radio station from the UK. You can have a listen to us on your DAB digital radio, on the free Fun Kids app, and as always at funkidslive.com.